Hey there, fellow journeyers. I just wanted to come on here real quick and let you know that the story coming up today is a great story, but it does involve a little bit more mature subject matter, but maybe a little bit different than what you're used to hearing. So I just wanted to come on here and give you that warning before the show starts. Anyway, on with the show.
The unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey 119 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Amid the Steep Sky's Commotion, a tale of the airship Ozymandias by Josh Roseman. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. Believe it or not, I actually have a full cast audio produced story for you today. I know those are few and far between these days, but I think this is one you're going to enjoy. As most full cast stories that I talk about these days, this one has had a long and sordid history in its production. I guess just the short version is I originally was going to produce this. I was running out of time with several things going on. And so I hit up Christopher Monroe, who's produced stories for the podcast before, to see if he could do it. And he worked on it for a while. He got some of the voice acting done for it and started putting things together. And several things happened in his life where he wasn't able to finish production on it. So eventually I did talk to another producer who was going to do it, but they realized they weren't going to be able to do it given the scope of being full cast and everything. And it is a longer story. So they realized pretty quick that they weren't going to be able to produce it. And so I was going to, bite the bullet and do it myself. It would just have to fall in with whenever everything else came through. But then I decided to ask Jeremy Carter, who had produced a story or two, I think, for the Dune Steve podcast. And I asked him if he'd be willing to do it. I told him that there'd already been some voice work done, but I needed somebody to put it all together and to make a full production out of it. And so Jeremy agreed to take it on. And he finished it up. He wrapped it up and made it sound good. And I like what he's done with it. The story was written by Josh Roseman. And Josh has done voices here on the podcast before. And he does not play the trombone, but he does write stories. He also lives in Georgia, USA. And his writing has appeared in Asimov's Escape Pod and the crossed genres anthology, Fat Girl in a Strange Land. His fiction has been reprinted by the Dune Steve Audio Fiction Magazine, a fine podcast, and the Starship Sofa, another fine podcast. And he's done quite a bit of voice work and narration for, as I mentioned, the Journey Into podcast. He's voiced characters on the Dune Steve. He's also been on two of the Escape Artist podcasts and all five District of Wonders podcasts. And he is a good narrator as well. He is a 2013 graduate of the Taos Toolbox Writing Workshop. And when not writing, he is mostly complaining about the fact that he's not writing. So he did write this fine story for us. So let's go ahead and move on to the story. So come with me and let's journey into murder.
Thank you.
Amid the steep sky's commotion, a tale of the airship Ozymandias by Josh Roseman. Commander Markle folded his arms.
Well?
I looked past him, blood spread across the parquet floor of the dining cabin. Face down at the center of the room was a man in evening dress, the tails of his suit slowly soaking up the blood that had, until very recently, been inside his body. Except for the blood, the scene was quite peaceful. A few of the staff near the kitchen entrance, the chief steward standing beside the first mate. I just got here, Commander, I said, but it certainly looks like he's been murdered.
Bravo,
Markle said. He cleared his throat and leaned in my direction.
What are you going to do about it?
He was clearly trying to intimidate me, but I was more than 6 inches taller than him. It wasn't going to happen, nor was I going to rise to the bait. I slipped past Markle before he could do more than half-heartedly menace me. I had to get closer to the body, but the blood had spread too far. Since I didn't want to disturb the scene until I got a better look, I was going to have to step up onto a chair and walk from table to table. At least the tables didn't wobble. On an airship, everything was nailed down that could be nailed down. I certainly couldn't have done this on the ground, nor could I have done it in heels. Fortunately, given the nature of my job, I could get away with boots. I looked down at the corpse from the table nearest it. There was an awful lot of blood. My uniform skirt was going to be soaked by the time I was done examining the body. Mr. Peters, I called to the steward, I'll be needing a tablecloth.
They're at your disposal, Constable MacDonald.
Thank you. I stepped off the table and onto a chair, then gathered up the white linen in both hands and yanked. Unfortunately, not a single piece of china, cutlery, or glass remained in place. I smiled tightly at no one in particular as I folded the tablecloth into a pad. My boots made sticky noises in the blood as I eased myself onto the floor and laid the pad beside the body. After that, there was nothing for it but to smooth my skirt under my knees and lower myself the rest of the way. I pulled a pair of thin leather gloves out of my jacket pocket and worked them over my hands, then reached across the body and turned it onto its back. Even I couldn't hold back a small sound of surprise. It had been a long time since I'd seen a throat cut from ear to ear. That explained the amount of blood, at least. The man's face was locked in an expression of surprise, dark brown eyes stuck open by congealing blood. There was also a blotch of it on his lower stomach. I'd need to expose him to see more. I worked my fingers between the rent in the fabric and ripped. Blood misted over my skirt. I made a disgusted noise and removed my left glove so I could take a small kit out of my inner pocket. I flipped it open and set it next to me on the pad. Inside, some of the tools of my trade, including a long, narrow probe I could use to explore the wounds without touching them. But there was little to learn from the body. I got more from the contents of the dead man's pockets. A leather folio, room and wardrobe keys, assorted small change, and a flask half full of... I opened it and sniffed. Distressingly cheap vodka. As if there wasn't far better liquor available just about everywhere on the ship.
Constable, are you quite finished?
I glanced to the right. Commander Markle had assumed a bored expression. I think so.
Good. The staff needs to clean this room, and the passengers will be arriving for their late meals soon.
I got to my feet, folding the evidence into a clean-looking cloth napkin and tucking it into my jacket pocket, then picked my way back across the tables to the exit. Throat cut, I told the first mate. And stabbed, low in the body. I'm guessing it was a crime of passion.
Who was he?
I haven't looked yet. I want to get the evidence back to my office. Markle huffed air through his mustache, but stepped aside to let me pass.
Can we move him?
If you want, I called it over my shoulder. I was already on the way to the crew-only door at the far end of the passageway. Beyond it, a cramped corridor, pipes jutting out at odd angles, and dim bulbs lighting the way with a weak yellowish glow. I felt my skirt pulling where blood stuck it to my boots. I'd have to change before I went anywhere near the passengers. My office was a pocket-sized cabin a few yards aft of the bridge. I kept it as clean as possible, but inner rooms like this always smelled of mildew and used air. Markle had told me, when I had boarded for my first tour aboard the airship Ozymandias, that beggars couldn't be choosers. At least I was on the king of airships. 4 levels of passenger berthing and entertainment, multiple dining halls, even a theater for the showing of moving pictures or the acting of plays. It certainly rated more than a single constable, but I was all the Great American Airship Company cared to employ. I didn't care much about that anymore, but I still would have appreciated not paying for my own supplies, including the bright bulbs I'd had to install in my office lamps. They cast sterile white light that brought Marianne into sharp relief where she sat in my one guest chair, the only dirty thing in the pristine room. "I'm sorry," I said, dropping into my chair behind the desk. She reached for me and I took her hand.
"What happened?"
I squeezed her fingers. "One of the passengers was murdered. Someone cut his throat." Marianne made a face.
"That's awful."
"You have no idea." I didn't say it sharply, though. After dancing around each other for the better part of half a year, we were finally together, and I didn't want to push her away. Now I have to find out who he was, search his cabin, and then bring everything to St. Pierre. She pursed her lips.
"Do you want me to come with you?"
"You have duty."
"What I have,"
she said, pale eyes glinting under chestnut-brown bangs,
"is Chief Engineer Fredrickson eating out of my hand. I only need to ask."
I seriously considered it for a moment, but in the end I shook my head. "It'll be all right," I said. "The last thing he needs to know is that you and I are anything more than shipmates. He's not stupid."
"No. Just an ass."
Marianne's fingernails were cracked and dirty, but her palms were soft and her lips softer as she raised my hand to her mouth and kissed my fingers.
"I'll see you after shift."
I smiled. There was a hopeful note to her voice. "This figures to be a long night," I said. Her hands tensed, and I stroked her cheek with 2 fingers to try and soothe her. "I'll try not to be out too late."
"Please don't."
She kissed my hand again, then pulled away gently and left my office. It took me a full minute before I could concentrate enough to lay out the evidence on my bare wooden desk. The room and wardrobe keys told me the man had resided on the lowest level, the most expensive, most exclusive, with windows curving downward along the edge of the hull. I piled the change at one side, then opened the leather folio. "Well, then," the man's driving license proclaimed him to be Ignatius Robbins of Boston, Massachusetts. "Who were you, Mr. Robbins, that someone should hurt you so?" I rifled through the dead man's cash, more than $300 in assorted bills, and placed it near the change. It was expensive to fly Ozymandias, to be sure, but passengers bought their tickets in advance. I couldn't imagine needing more than $100, but then I'd never paid for the privilege of the journey. Robbins had kept a bank identification card in the folio, a photograph of himself with his arm around a similar-looking man, perhaps a brother, and a sealed paper envelope, half the size of a dollar, but thick enough to hold at least 5. "Drugs, Mr. Robbins? Really?" With a small, sharp paper knife, I slit open the envelope. It wasn't drugs I shook into my palm, though. It was sheets of what felt like rice paper covered in tiny writing. I looked at one through a magnifying glass. Then I let out a hissing, dismayed breath. Cyrillic lettering, Russian words. I read a few lines, feeling blood drain from my face. Mr. Ignatius Robbins of Boston had been engaged in espionage. I stopped at my cabin on the way to Robbins's. It was getting on to 8 o'clock, but I had to change. The room was far smaller than anything I'd had working groundside. Space was at a premium, even on a luxury liner. Still, I had a private bunk, as befit the ranking security constable, and if I had to sit on my bed to open my wardrobe, or sleep pressed up against the wall to share the space with Marianne, at least I had that much. The tiny washing-up cubicle wasn't so terrible, either. The entertainers had their own quarters on another level, thankfully. Those twittering birds were the last thing I needed after a long night walking the decks. I changed into a fresh maroon skirt and rubbed a cloth over my boots until the blood was gone. After a brief stop in the crew lavatory to wash my hands, I went to the lowest level and located Ignatius Robbins's cabin. It wasn't the most lavish, but it was close. I put on gloves and reached for the door handle. The polished wood swung open before I could even try the key. I reached into my jacket for my baton, which lived in a pocket along my spine. The metal rod was warm, even through my glove. I held it at the ready and stepped into the doorway. "This is Constable MacDonald. Identify yourself." Something crashed out of view, probably in the private washroom. I closed the door behind me to protect the other passengers from seeing anything potentially unpleasant before moving through the stateroom, baton raised. "Step out with your hands up," I snapped in my best stern teacher voice. "Do it now." "All right." A woman. I hadn't expected that. She sidled out of the washroom, hands at shoulder level. "Sit down, please." I gestured to the bed with the baton. She did as I said, curling in on herself a bit as if afraid I'd hit her, or worse. A man might have, probably would have, taken advantage, but I didn't believe in unnecessary violence or forcing myself on a suspect, even an attractive one, and this one was very attractive. "What's your name?" She blinked huge green eyes at me. "Katya," she said, her voice flavored European, but not quite Russian. "Katya Irina." "What are you doing down here? Shouldn't you be..." I made a vague motion toward the upper decks. I'd recognized Miss Irina's name from the manifest as one of the dancers in the questionably tasteful review that ran middays. While wives visited the health spa or played cards, their husbands crowded into the small dark theater to stare at Katya and the other women. She swallowed. "Ignatius, he..." She had the decency to look ashamed. "He hired me last night." I tried not to look as though I'd tasted something unpleasant. It was against contract to do what Irina had done, but management unofficially asked constables to overlook the activity. "How did you get in?" "The door was not locked," she told me. "I came for what I left last night." "And that is?" Now she did blush, gesturing to her very short skirt. "All right, I get it." I sighed, putting the baton away before sitting in the room's one chair. "Have you seen Robbins today?"
"Not since this morning."
Irina ran one hand through thick blonde hair. The move made her body shift provocatively under her tightly buttoned blouse. I managed not to look away. It was clearly a practiced motion, intended to attract attention.
"Why do you ask?"
"Because he is dead." To her credit, the dancer pulled off a good impression of a devastated lover, but I knew better. She'd been here because Robbins had paid her. She didn't really have any ties to him. "Can you think of anyone who'd want to hurt him?" I asked. She shook her head, hair falling around her face, eyes downcast. She even manufactured a couple of tears, which dripped from her narrow nose and spattered on her stockinged thigh.
"He was a gentleman," she said.
Then she looked up at me.
"Am I safe, Constable MacDonald?"
"Did you kill him?"
"I did not."
"Then you are safe from me, at least." I ran my palms over my knees. "Stay in company, just in case. But I think you'll be all right." I waved to the door. "Go on. I know where to find you if I need you." She didn't say anything else, just got out of there. I locked the cabin door behind her and began searching the room. The wardrobe yielded nothing much, just clothing that befit a gentleman of leisure and a couple of walking sticks, neither of which concealed swords, not that I really expected to find them. But it was a bit odd that there were no weapons at all among his belongings. Spies were said to value their lives very highly. A quick search of the drawers and the bedside tables revealed nothing but a pad of writing paper and a sharpened pencil. I was luckier in the washroom. In the center of the toilet roll, I found another thick envelope curled up and stuck there by two dabs of what smelled like spirit gum. I wiped my fingers on the hand towel and put the envelope into my jacket. Then rechecked all of Robin's toiletries on the off chance he'd secreted something inside one of the bottles. He hadn't, of course. The toilet roll had been a very good hiding place. Before leaving, I lifted the toilet lid just to check. Oh, that's vile. Robbins hadn't had the courtesy to pull the chain after his last trip. I dropped the wooden disc back onto the bowl and tugged the small handle on the wall behind. Nothing happened. Had this been a routine search for contraband, I might have let it be and called a mechanic. But given the situation, I was taking nothing for granted. Upon closer inspection, the tiny silver screws holding the panel behind the handle were definitely damaged, probably by a screwdriver not made for this size or head. I used the small driver in my little leather case to remove the panel so I could reach into the opening. Another envelope. I took it out and examined it. Thicker than either of the others, and the humidity of the plumbing had loosened the gumming along the seal. It was already almost open. My thumb teased the flap the rest of the way off, and I peered inside. $100 bills. At least 50 of them. I cursed quietly. As if a murdered spy wasn't bad enough, now I had to deal with one who might have been working for the highest bidder. I locked the cabin behind me and made for the bridge. I needed to speak with the captain. Captain St. Pierre wasn't happy to be in his office talking to me, not this late in the evening, and he didn't try to hide it.
I'm really quite busy, Mrs. MacDonald.
He never said my rank, either. I know, sir. I opened the flat metal box where I'd put Robbins's rice paper and handed the captain a magnifying glass. But look at this. The captain huffed, but did as I asked. He only glanced, though.
I don't read this language, Mrs. MacDonald.
I suppressed a sigh. It's Russian, sir. These are state secrets, I think.
Really now?
He looked again, then shrugged, broad shoulders shifting beneath his maroon jacket. He set dark brown eyes on me.
Do you believe he was killed for them?
I don't know yet.
Did you find anything else, Mrs. MacDonald?
Every time he called me that, I had to fight down the urge to snarl at him. I hadn't been married for years, but for propriety's sake, the company said I had to be treated as if I still had a husband. Not that the captain cared. His hand had accidentally brushed my backside far too many times over the past year for it to be much of an accident anymore. He had hidden more documents in his toilet roll. St. Pierre laughed.
You're not being paid to clean his washroom, Mrs. MacDonald.
I bit the inside of my lip as hard as I could.
Was there more?
No, sir. Except the money. But I wasn't telling him about that. Not now, and perhaps not ever. The ass.
Then figure out who killed him. Figure out why, and soon. I don't want a killer on my airship. Understand?
Yes, Captain.
And try not to anger too many of the passengers.
He offered me a flash of a smile, teeth bright white in his dark Caribbean face.
The last thing we need is to be giving refunds because Mrs. MacDonald stepped on the wrong toes.
My teeth were clenched tightly enough that, if I kept it up, I would have a spectacular headache. No, sir, I said through them.
Good.
His hand on my lower back was overly familiar as he ushered me out of his office, but I endured it. At least he tried to be subtle. The one and only time Commander Merkel had pinched my backside, I'd broken his fingers, and paid dearly for it out of my wages. Worth it, though. I separated the evidence into three plain white envelopes, then locked it all in my safe. Except for the money. I couldn't guarantee I had the only key to my safe, and it was a lot of cash. I counted it again, then put it into my jacket. $6,500. If the killer knew about the money, he or she would most certainly come looking for it. Better to keep it on my person. I sighed. $6,500 was enough for me to quit the company and disappear. Enough for Rebecca MacDonald to die quietly and be reinvented in Spain or France. I spoke both languages well enough. All I had to do was repair the handle plate in Robbins's cabin. Marianne would be glad to help me there, I was certain. And say nothing of the money. Money. It had spelled the end of my career with the San Francisco Police Department. After my first partner's death, I'd been paired with a clumsy, easily bribed nincompoop who'd pinned his theft of $700 on me. As far as I knew, he was still taking bribes and menacing citizens, while I looked down from tens of thousands of feet and tried to figure out who had killed a spy. And of course, the company didn't pay women nearly as well as men. I had precious little left over after paying for a room back in California that I only used 1 week out of every four. I touched the envelope in my pocket one more time, then squared my shoulders and headed out to the entertainment deck. I still had a job to do. The money would wait, whatever I decided to do with it. Most of the 300 or so passengers were on the entertainment deck. It was the largest deck on the airship, and for at least some portion of the evening, everyone made it up here. It would have been suspicious not to. I looked in on the main dining cabin. No one taking a late meal seemed the worse for wear, and the help had cleaned the floor. But word had got around nonetheless, and a couple of passengers asked me if I'd caught the culprit yet. I can't discuss an active investigation, I said to an older man walking with his wife and sons, both of whom leered openly at me. But are we safe? His wife asked. Of course, I told her. You have nothing to worry about. The Great American Airship Company prides itself on being the safest there is. The conversation was repeated, with minor changes, as I made my rounds. I eventually ended up on the open foredeck, jacket buttoned tightly, hands deep in my pockets. We were moving at speed, and with the sun gone, the wind sliced through me as efficiently as the killer's knife had slashed the throat of the late Mr. Robbins. Not many passengers chose to spend their evenings out here, though one young couple was at the very prow, her red hair streaming out behind her as he held her round the waist so she could lean up against the railing. I smiled ruefully. Once upon a time, I'd had a husband, and we'd had our own moments of closeness. But now, if anyone saw me holding my lover like that, I'd probably be thrown over the side, and her soon after. Someone tapped my shoulder. I spun quickly, stepping back, but it was only Mr. Peters, the chief steward. Dining cabin closed? I asked.
Yes.
He breathed deeply, then inclined his head at the couple.
Sweet, isn't it?
If you like that sort of thing, I shivered. Did you need something, Mr. Peters? He shook his head.
Please, call me Tony.
Tony, then. I felt the wind trying to pry my hair out of its long braid. Is something on your mind?
You have to ask.
I hitched one shoulder, a half shrug. I'm no psychologist, I said. The medic can give you something to calm your nerves if you like.
It didn't bother you. At all?
Tony had his hands tucked under his folded arms. Instead of a coat, he wore a dark blue cape fastened in front with three silver buckles. That's not it. I felt the airship bank slightly. The wind ceased to blow quite so fiercely into our faces. The couple at the prow was kissing now, her back pressed into the metal railing. I've seen worse, I swallowed. There's just a lot on my mind.
Why? Was there something strange about the killing?
I turned to him. You seem awfully interested.
It did happen in my dining cabin.
Ah. I suppose you're right, but I interviewed your staff already. I'd done it before my rounds. No one had seen the actual killing, but two waiters confirmed that Irina and Robbins were together all through the dinner hour. I very much wanted to know why she'd lied to me, but interrupting Irina while she was entertaining would just draw the captain's attention, and that wouldn't be helpful at all. I'd have to wait until tomorrow morning. The only possible suspect is one of the dancing girls. I don't think she could have done it, though.
Why not?
Now I gave him a sharp look. I think you know enough about the entertainers on this airship to know the answer to that. If she killed him, how could he pay her? He smiled, apologetic.
So what will you do?
The murder weapon was probably tossed over the side, I said, but that doesn't matter. I'll find who did it, and he, or she, will pay for the crime. Tony nodded, apparently in approval, then left the foredeck via the portside door. The couple departed the same way, but I stayed out in the open a while longer, despite the wind and the cold. I was going to figure out who killed Ignatius Robbins. Somehow. I thought I left all this behind 2 years ago, I said softly, my breath ruffling Marianne's hair. I thought I was just a constable on an airship now. Marianne and I were pressed tightly together, huddled under my too small, too thin blanket. She'd slipped into the bed after I'd fallen asleep, but her warmth and the scent of soap and skin had woken me.
You're more than just a constable, Rebecca.
My arm was over her body. She pressed my hand between hers.
You're my constable.
I know. I kissed the top of her head. She was even shorter than the first mate, and fit very nicely against me in this position. I just wished everything wasn't a damned competition. She nodded. We both know that if I went to the captain or Commander Markle, they'd find a way to use it against me, to say I wasn't competent. They already didn't like me. Well, that wasn't quite true. They liked that I was a woman and that I was pleasant to look at. No wonder Marianne tried to do all the dirty jobs. Why dig through layers of grime and soot and cleaning fluid? More fool they. I'm going to have to talk to the crew tomorrow, I said. The entertainers, the engineers, everyone. And if it's not one of them...
Then we'll see.
She brought my hand to her mouth again, kissed my fingers slowly before running her lips over the pad of my thumb. I suddenly felt very warm inside.
What about that dancer?
What about her? I struggled to think. Robbins would have paid her.
Would he?
Marianne turned to face me, cupped my cheek with one hand.
Look at how they treat you. What if Robbins wasn't any better?
Irina said he was a gentleman, I said. Marianne's eyes were silver in the moonlight coming through the tiny porthole. I'm sure he paid and paid well. Marianne kissed me, then said,
You think too well of people for someone who used to be a police detective.
Well, she did lie to me. Should I go wake her up? Question her again?
Yes.
Another kiss.
But not just now.
Irina wasn't in the cabin she shared with the other dancers. None of them were very pleased to be woken up at 7:30, but I didn't care. Where's Katya Irina? The red-haired one peered across the room. Irina's bunk was one of six crammed into the space. Out. She'll be back at lunchtime. This was the brunette in the bunk just below. She had a sleeping mask over her face and hadn't bothered to remove her makeup. Lipstick was smeared on her pillow. I'll tell her you stopped by. The last was barely intelligible around a yawn. You do that. I left the cabin and stalked through the narrow corridor to the crew staircase, making my way down to the lowest level. Robbins's cabin door was open. I reached for my baton, but when I heard the captain's voice, I knew I didn't have to bother. and that I wasn't going to like what was about to happen.
There you are, Mrs. MacDonald.
He sounded both satisfied and angry, and he stressed the Mrs. once again.
Looks like we've found your killer.
Behind the captain, Katya Irina stood, arms held by the junior navigator and the meteorologist. Captain?
It's over, Mrs. MacDonald. People were talking more about a dead passenger than the food or the shows or, God help me, the girls. I can't have that on my ship. That's not keeping the peace, and you know it.
I took a closer look at the dancer. One side of her face was angry and red, and she was crying. What were you doing here, Katya? I tried to sound kind. She needed someone on her side.
She said she left something here,
said the meteorologist. He didn't sound happy about being conscripted to take a passenger into custody, and I didn't blame him.
The captain...
He bit his lip. The captain glared at him.
Captain St-Pierre questioned Miss Irina, and she said Robbins refused to pay her that first night.
So she caught him after dinner. He wouldn't pay, and she killed him.
I was watching Irina, though. Her jaw was set, her face hard, even though she was crying. Her green eyes met mine, and I knew. Captain, it doesn't add up, I said, turning to him. Robbins had $300 in his wallet, and thousands more in his cabin, but I definitely wasn't telling the captain about that now. He could afford to pay her 6 times what she'd charge.
And she killed him anyway, didn't you, girl?
When the dancer didn't respond, the captain backhanded her across the other cheek. She slumped, probably feigning unconsciousness. Probably a good move.
And as for you, you're off my ship when we get to Boston.
He advanced, and I gave ground. When I'd been on the force, I'd have stood up to him, but here I had no backup. Here, Captain St-Pierre was the law.
Your assets are in the company bank, aren't they? It'll be quite the challenge to get home to San Francisco without any money.
He was very close now.
Perhaps by then you'll be properly humbled,
he said, low and vicious.
Perhaps I'll let you back on my airship.
His hand came up, and I flinched. I couldn't help it, but all he did was touch my cheek, then my shoulder, then my breast.
In a far more revealing uniform, I think. One that befits a woman without usable skills.
He smiled, and in that moment I was truly afraid.
Perhaps Miss Irina will teach you some of hers.
Marianne found me in the plumbing room, hidden behind the water tank. When I saw her, I grabbed her and hugged her as hard as I could, disregarding the state of her clothes, not caring about the dirt transferring from her to me. If I have to kill the captain, I said, please tell the police it was self-defense. Her arms went around me. She rocked me gently.
He's a bastard,
she whispered, stroking my shoulders. He's putting me off the ship in Boston.
Oh, Rebecca.
She kissed my shoulder. He suggested. I successfully fought down a sob. He suggested I whore my way back to California. Marianne had no words. She held me, I don't know for how long. Until I was able to breathe normally. Until my heart stopped hammering. Katya lied, I finally said.
What?
I leaned against the bulkhead. Marianne held my hand, ran her thumb over my knuckles. She lied to the captain. I sighed. Well, you probably know what he did. There were witnesses, though. She had to confess, even if it wasn't true.
Then who did it?
I wish I knew. I took a deep breath. I've got 4 days to figure it out, though.
Do you want my help?
I shook my head. Don't get involved, Marianne. Don't go down with me. She opened her mouth to protest, but I kept going. I love you. I don't want you throwing your career away from me.
It's my career.
Marianne, I said, voice flat. And that was that. She knew that tone, knew there would be no more compromises. She turned.
Pride goes before the fall,
she said, and left the plumbing room. Maybe Marianne was right. But I wasn't done with this case. Not even close. Hidden in an out-of-the-way corner of Deck 2 was a locked room with a cot, privy, and basin. When passengers got drunk and violent and needed to sleep it off, I locked them in. I figured it was where the captain would put Irina, but when I got there, I found Tony Peters, the chief steward, leaning over a red-uniformed crewman who was on the deck, clutching his groin and gasping.
"I came with her food,"
Tony said.
"She kicked him and ran."
"Damn," I drew my baton. "Did she say anything?"
"That she was going to jump. That no one would believe her anyway."
I turned and bolted. There was only one place she could be going. At 8:30, few passengers were up and about. The dining cabin didn't open until 9 anyway. I had to dodge only 2 or 3 people as I sprinted along the length of the entertainment deck and burst through the foredeck door. Katya Irina was holding onto the railing, staring straight ahead. "Don't do it," I said. She looked back, saw me holding the baton. I put it away and moved toward her. "Katya, please, this isn't the answer."
"So I go to prison for murder, or worse?"
Her fingers were curled tightly around the metal, her hair flowing as the airship continued on course.
"I did nothing wrong."
"Katya," I said, "tell me the truth."
"The truth,"
she laughed, scornful. But when I joined her at the railing, she did as I asked.
"The truth is that the Robbins was a nice man, sweet, tender,"
she smiled.
"Not like many of the others. We talked for a long time, and I said goodbye, but I left without the money."
"So you met him in the dining cabin?"
"And he apologized and said he would pay and invited me to eat with him."
"You had to be on stage right after the dinner hour, though, so you left before he did?"
"Yes."
She was crying, real tears this time. Before the captain had had her imprisoned, she could have written it off, could have moved on to another passenger. Not now, though.
"He gave me a key to his cabin, told me to wait."
"Why did you lie to me?" I asked. "Why not just tell me everything when I found you last night?" She sniffed, a derisive noise.
"You are the constable. Why would you believe me?"
I shook my head. "Come on, let's get out of here."
"Where will I go?"
"My cabin, for starters. I'll find you somewhere else to hide until I uncover the real killer." Irina touched my shoulder.
"Thank you, constable."
I smiled. "Please, call me Rebecca." I led her to the port side door and opened it. Something slammed into my shoulder. I shoved Irina out of the way and fell backward, avoiding another strike. "What the hell?" I blinked tears out of my eyes. "Tony?" The chief steward had a long wrench in his hand. He swung again. I rolled, yanking my baton out of my jacket. The next time he tried to hit me, I was ready. I grabbed the wrench and pulled him to the deck, punching at his jaw with the fist clenched around the baton. He howled in pain as I got to my feet, legs still shaky from that first blow. "What are you doing?" Peters managed to get up, holding his face, the wrench held out like a sword as if he were some sort of fencer. I gripped the baton more tightly.
"She told you, didn't she?"
It wasn't a question. What the hell is going on?
"She told you she didn't kill Robbins."
Oh, my dear God. You killed him?" Peters stepped closer to Katya and pulled a clasp knife from his pocket, then flicked it open. The morning sun glimmered on the blade. He pointed at the railing with the wrench. Katya dropped to her knees and huddled, making herself as small as possible. Then to me he said,
"I had my orders."
"Your orders?" He smiled and sketched a salute with the wrench.
"Anton Petrovich, at your service. Or more precisely, in service of the Tsar."
"You're the spy?" Peters Petrovich laughed.
"No, no, my dear constable. Robbins was most definitely the spy. And a very good one, too. He stole classified information from the Russian consulate. The telegram was very clear. Kill him, recover the documents, find someone to take the blame.
I looked more closely at the knife. It was about the right size for the stab wound in Robbins' stomach. You were sloppy, I told him. I shouldn't have gotten my hands on the information.
I didn't have a lot of time.
Petrovich's hand darted out. Katya cowered back and shielded herself with her arms. The knife left a bright line of blood on her skin.
And you were so damned efficient. You found the plans before I could get to Robin's cabin that night.
His face went hard.
You ruined everything for me, Constable MacDonald. Everything!
It was a furious shout. The airship hit a bump of turbulence. Katya whimpered. I kept my feet, but Petrovich dropped to one knee. I advanced, but he turned the knife as if to throw it. I had no doubt he could kill me that way. I wished I could carry a pistol, but guns were prohibited. One careless bullet could puncture the giant aluminum-encased balloon hanging above our heads. Petrovich stood again, smiling.
You have a simple choice, Constable MacDonald. Say nothing, go along with the tramp's confession, and when we get to Boston, make your report to the company. You'll never see nor hear from me again.
He brandished the wrench.
Or there could be a fight, and you both could die.
Except for the little matter of Katya going to prison for a crime she hadn't committed, Petrovich's plan sounded pretty good, given what the captain had in store for me. Especially since I still had the money. The money. What about the money? His eyes narrowed.
What money?
He didn't know. The Tsar's government must have withheld that detail, or perhaps the money was intended to help Robbins disappear until the Russians forgot what he'd done. Not that that would help. The Tsar was known for his long memory. I found money along with the documents. A plan formed in my mind. Thousands of dollars. You can have it if you let us live. Petrovich clicked his tongue.
Come now, Constable. Why shouldn't I just kill you? And take the money anyway.
I suppose you have a point. I tucked the baton under my arm, but didn't put it away. Go on, then. Kill me. You'll never find it. Petrovich's smile returned, toothy and unpleasant. He waved the knife at Katya.
Run, little tramp. Hide. Don't let me see you again. Katya
looked at me. I nodded, and she ran for it. Even if she was caught by the captain again, it was far better than being at Petrovich's mercy. Once the dancer was gone, Petrovich gestured toward the door with the wrench.
Lead on, Constable.
I shook my head. You really believed I wouldn't keep the money on me? I took the envelope out of my jacket and held it up. The wind tried to tug it out of my fingers. $6,500, Petrovich. A lot of money. He closed the knife and jammed it into his pocket, then reached out.
Give it to me. Now.
No. I took a $100 bill from the envelope and let it go. The wind carried it to the back wall of the foredeck. I think not. Then I dropped the envelope.
You bitch!
He dove for the money as bills scattered everywhere. His hand closed on the envelope, still half full of cash. When he looked back, he wore a triumphant expression. It lasted all of half a second before I smashed the baton across the bridge of his nose. Blood spurted as he brought the wrench up in a clumsy arc. I cracked the baton on his hand, and as the wrench clanged to the deck, I dropped to one knee and punched the metal rod into his chest, all my weight and strength behind the blow. Bone cracked. Petrovich's eyes went wide. He opened his mouth to scream, but all that came out was a spray of blood. I don't know how long it took him to die, but in the end, it didn't really matter. U.S. Marshals met me at the port and escorted me to their Boston office, where I was debriefed. I told the truth, except for one small detail, and the marshals didn't seem inclined to press the issue. They also took the captain into custody. They hadn't looked kindly upon his mistreatment of Katya, and trying to save face, the company let them keep him. I was in the care of the marshals for 4 days. The Ozymandias left without me after 2 for her return trip to San Francisco. Not that it mattered. The marshals were so grateful that I'd recovered the intelligence and eliminated an agent of the Tsar that they booked me in a luxury cabin on the California Limited 3. I boarded the train the next morning at 8, and half an hour later went to the dining car for a late breakfast. I was just spreading jam onto my toast when I heard a voice I couldn't fail to recognize.
Hello, Rebecca.
I smiled at Marianne as she slid into the seat across from me and reached out to take my hands in hers.
Surprised?
Very. The Ozymandias left days ago, apparently without her engineer's mate. Do you still have a job? She grinned.
I told you Fredrickson was eating out of my hand. He convinced Commander Markel. I'm not getting paid, but it's worth it.
Her palms were warm, fingers rough in places with calluses from years of working in engine compartments.
Even though you were a little sharp with me.
My eyes prickled with tears. I'm sorry, Marianne.
It's all right.
There were too many people in the dining car for her to kiss my fingers, but I know she wanted to.
I forgive you.
The waiter came to take Marianne's order, and once he was gone, I asked her if she got the note I'd sent. Sequestered by the marshals, it was the only way I could get a message out.
I did. I tried to write back, but they said you couldn't receive any communications from outside.
I made a face, which made Marianne chuckle. At least you're here now. At least you found my train. Her lips tightened at that, and I stroked her wrist. What is it?
Not that I regret being here. But the ticket was...
She blushed.
I'm sorry, Rebecca, but this is expensive. And you know how much the company pays women. Even high-ranking women like us.
Don't worry about it. I reached into my jacket and showed Marianne the edge of the envelope. I saw her stunned expression and felt myself smile. They asked. I lied. They didn't push it. I tucked it back into my inside pocket. We have nothing to worry about. Not this trip. Maybe not ever.
Rebecca.
Shush now, I said in my best mock authoritative tone. We've got a week to talk about money. I stroked her fingers, her cheeks flushed pink. Among other things. The comrade of thy wanderings over heaven, as then when to outstrip thy skyey speed, scarce seemed a vision. I would ne'er have striven. Percy Bysshe Shelley, Ode to the West Wind.
The cast of characters for this story includes Julie Holverson of the 19 Nocturne Boulevard podcast, who played Constable McDonald, and Katya Urina. Rishi Outfield as Tony Peters, a.k.a. Anton Petrovich, Christopher Monroe as Captain St. Pierre, Becky Shrimpton as Marianne, Jeremy Carter as the meteorologist, and I, lovable furry old Marshall, as Commander Markel. I hope you enjoyed that story. I think this is definitely one of the first steampunk type stories that I've done here on the podcast. It's also, I think, one of the first murder mysteries. There's been some of that with some of the suspense episodes that I've done. But I think this is the first true murder mystery that I've done here on the podcast. That's one of the first things I primarily liked about this story was that it was a steampunk story, but it was different than other steampunk stories that I'd heard. It didn't have a lot of the common cliches. It had some in there. In fact, we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I also liked that it was a murder mystery, that it was in a different setting, and it was compelling, not only in figuring out who done it, but figuring out how Constable McDonald was going to get around the barriers that she had around her with the captain and the commander and not getting any respect. Yeah, so I thought that was a good thing. And I do like a good steampunk type story. In fact, you know, I've listened to podcasts all over the years, and there was a
I think it was called Follow That Cathedral, that was a steampunk type story. And somebody on the forums, the Podcastle forums, kind of went through and said, you know, it seemed like they were just trying to cover all of the steampunk points, you know. And then he provided a list of things that had to be in a steampunk story. And so I've always remembered that in the back of my mind, that this list of requirements. So when I got ready to prepare for this, talking about this story, I went back and found that post on the forums. And I realized when I saw who the poster was, I'm like, I think that's actually the screen name or the forum name of Josh Roseman, who wrote this story. And so as I looked through the list, I thought it was interesting that many of these characteristics are included in this story. When I asked Josh whether creating that list was the impetus for this story or whatnot, all he really said was that those two things might be related. So anyway, let's go through this list and see how it compares. The first item on the list is a corset. And I think that refers to steampunk is usually in the Victorian era, and the women at that time wore corsets and long dresses and whatnot. I did look through the text of the story. There is no particular mention of a corset in the story, but I guess that's still what I envisioned Constable MacDonald was wearing. But there is no specific mention of a corset. The next item on the list is ambiguous sexual preference by a female character. Definitely, I don't think in this story the sexual preference was ambiguous. She was obviously in a relationship with Marianne there. Russians is the next item on the list. So we can count that as a checkoff item for that. Trains is the next item. There we go. We had trains at the end of the story there. Airships. Obviously, the setting of the story was on an airship. Swords? Not really. It does mention that Petrovich wielded his wrench at her in a fencing style as if it were a sword, but it wasn't. It was only a wrench. So we're going to say no on that one. Cool guns? No, there were no guns in this story, basically because I think they were on the airship, and guns wouldn't be a good idea. Here's an interesting one. At least one person dead on the floor killed before the story began. That was definitely in this story. That is how this story began, with a dead person on the floor. So that led to our murder mystery. You know, I don't know. That's an interesting that it's on this list. You know, that's definitely a characteristic of a murder mystery type story. I don't know if all of the steampunk stories that I've read have that on there. So that's interesting. The next item on the list is the good guy wins. And yes, the good gal won in this case. The last item on the list is that the bad guy isn't killed at the end of the story to leave the door open for a sequel. Now, Petrovich, our good Russian spy here, was definitely killed in the story. It says it outright. But if you include in that bad guy categorization of the captain of the airship and Commander Markel and those types of things, I guess they did continue on and could. And so the door is left open for a sequel with those characters. He does say here that there's more things. There's probably more things on the list. I guess other things I typically consider when I'm thinking of a steampunk type story, it would be that it does take place in England, and there would be cobblestone streets and things like that. And we don't have that in this story. I thought that was an interesting take too, that this all takes place in America. The airship was traveling between Boston and California and San Francisco. So that was a new part to this story. So another item that I would put in that category would be something that has to do with Nikolai Tesla. So that wasn't in this story either. So anyway, good story. And I'm glad that we were finally able to get it out there, that Josh's story is out there. I'm finally getting these stories done and out the door. I do have another story that I'm asking for somebody to help me produce it. It's another one that's been around for a long time, and unfortunately, the author won't be able to hear this story. It's by Eugene Foster, and it's a great story. It's one that I've wanted to get on the air for a long time. I think I've even had it longer than this one, but it does require certain accents in the story. I've been trying to get those right. There have been a couple producers on that one as well. I think, sorry to the Doonstief crew, but I did ask another one of their producers to produce this story for me. Justin Charles has agreed to produce it for me. So it was funny that when I asked him to do it, he says, "Well, I'm working on a story for Big, so it might take, you know, if you need it right away, I won't be able to do it. Or if there's a time limit on it, I might not be able to do it." And I'm like, "Well, you know, if you get it done by a certain date, you know, several months in advance." He's like, "Well, no, I just meant a couple weeks." So, but I do need to get him some information on that. So that's probably the last story that's had that much of an age on it. Unfortunately, like I said, Yuji died last year, and I'm really sad. Well, first of all, I'm sad that she passed away, and that we won't be able to read any more of her stories, and sad for her family, her husband, and those types of things. But I'm also sad that she won't be able to hear the full cast version production of this story. But I do want to get it out there, and I do want to dedicate it to her. I enjoy her writing and her stories, and I was so grateful that she was able to, that she gave me this story. So there's that coming up. I'm very close to being done with a story by Kevin J. Anderson. A small story that he wrote for his, on Valentine's Day, for his wife. yep, I missed that date as well. But it's a fun little story, and I've had it for quite a while as well. So that should be coming up here pretty soon. I am going to need to move the date for Edgar Allan Poe Month back to June. There's been some things that have come up in Ken's life, and the story hasn't come as quick for him as it usually does. And so I want to give him some time to finish that up and to feel good about the story and to give us the best story he can. So I am going to be moving Edgar Allan Poe Month to June. But I'm excited about that. I really feel good about the story that he's writing, and I feel good about the other things that I have lined up for that. So there's that to look forward to. I do have another Abigail Hilton story to do, a small story from her Prophet of Panamandora series. It ties in with those, and I think you'll like that. So those are some of the stories upcoming. Of course, I'm going to continue to do the Journey into History segments every month. All of the feedback that I've received for that has been good. People have been enjoying those, and I enjoy them as well. I've dedicated to do them for the rest of the year, and we'll see what happens from then on. Some other exciting things coming up with the podcast. I'm deciding to consolidate a lot of things that I'm doing. One of the things that you may or may not have known about was the Delusions of Grandeur Star Wars podcast that I do with Rich Outfield. We've been pretty good about getting episodes out every month. We've missed a couple months here and there just due to schedules and whatnot. But we've put out 13 episodes of that podcast, but I haven't done a good job of publicizing that, of getting it on iTunes. I can't, you know, it's hard to find. I haven't given out the URL feed for people to find. I've put links to it on the Facebook page for Delusions of Grandeur, and I've done that on the Facebook page for Journey Into a couple times as well. But I really don't feel like it has enough exposure and things like that. So I'm going to roll the Delusions of Grandeur episodes into this podcast. It's going to be part of the Journey Into podcast. I often have high hopes and high expectations for myself and this podcast and what it could become. because I really do have a lot of ideas about it and ways to really make this a lot more than it is. But I also know the reality of the situation and the time that I have available and the things that I'm involved in. So anyway, long story short, you're going to start hearing Delusions of Grandeur podcasts here as part of the Journey Into podcast. It's going to be Journey Into Star Wars. We have Journey Into History segments. We're going to have Journey Into Star Wars segments where it'll just be a continuation of the things that Rish and I have been doing for the last year or so. And I'll still continue to play old-time radio shows. I'll still continue to have full cast productions of contemporary short stories. And I'll still continue to do Edgar Allan Poe month and hopefully contests and things like that. But it'll just be all together now. And I think you'll receive more content here on the show. And hopefully you'll enjoy all that. So anyway, that's some of the stuff that's going on with this podcast. I need to pull all of that together and figure out how to bring that together in a good way that makes sense to everybody. So you might see more. Well, you'll definitely see newer shows of Delusions of Grandeur or Journey Into Star Wars Delusions of Grandeur show up on this feed. I'll probably end up putting the past shows on here as well. I just don't want to overload the feed with stuff. So that's what's going on. That's what's going on around the podcast. Here's what's going on in your neck of the woods. Oh no, wait a minute. I'm not Al Roker. I'm still having fun. I'm still enjoying this podcast. I hope you are as well. And we will get back. And we'll be back here shortly with another story for you. Or some other way to please your ears. Hopefully. So, until next time, kids. Be safe out there. And journey on.
Hi, this is Josh Roseman, author of sci-fi stories that have appeared in Asimov's, Starship Sofa, The Dune Steve, and Escape Pod. Also, you might have heard my voice on such podcasts as Starship Sofa, Escape Pod, The Dune Steve, and this here Journey Into podcast, which is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it however and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space. If you enjoyed this outro, you might enjoy my other works, which you can find at roseplusman.com. That's it. It's over. Go away.
Oh my goodness, people. Why are you coming now? It's a nice day. Let's go to the park. Even though Marshall wants to record today, he tried to record the other day, but it was raining. He can't record in his house anymore because too many things are going on. So we're just all going to go to the park so he can't produce his story here. It is spring break this week, I guess. Well, let's get the dog out.